Chapter 15. From the morning when Daniel went back to hear Jesus on the shore of Capernaum, life in the village began to seem less burdensome. Though he would have been surprised if he had stopped to realize it, the long hot days of the month of Ab came to be the happiest he had ever known. He went first because Joel had asked him to, and because he was still curious to find what it was about the preacher that had drawn first Simon and then Joel. 2 days later, he went back again because he could not get the words of the carpenter out of his head. After that, nearly every morning in the week he rose before dawn and walked 3 miles to the city to join the little crowd that always waited at the shore. Though it meant that his shop would be late in opening, Simon encouraged his coming, and he seemed glad to see him. Daniel could meet Joel and talk with him freely, and often he had the added reward of Thaddeus' flashing smile. Even the fishermen came to greet him by name. It was harder to explain to himself why he sometimes was drawn to Bethsaida at night, when he could not expect to meet Joel, and when he could only sit in the little garden of Simon's house and listen to the words of Jesus. He did not always understand the words, and often he walked home puzzled and impatient, but a few nights later, almost against his will, he would go again. He was still not sure what Jesus intended to do, but day after day the hope and promise in Jesus' words drew him back. At mealtimes he told Leah the stories he had heard. Sometimes he thought that if the long walks to Capernaum and the hours away from his work had accomplished nothing else, they had at least given him something to talk to Leah about.
"Was Andrew there?" she would ask. "Did he have a lot of fish in his net? Did the rich women come and bring food for the poor people?"
She would sit with her own food untouched, wanting only to listen. Often when he returned late at night, she would bounce up on her mat, her eyes shining with wakefulness, and hug her knees with her arms. Even when he was too tired to think, he would manage some bit of news before he climbed to his bed on the rooftop, or the disappointment in her face would nag at him. It puzzled him that this timid creature who had never dared to venture beyond their tiny garden patch should now be so curious about the busy life of the city. How could he possibly make her see it, when she had never even glimpsed the little crossroads and the well and the small flat synagogue that made up the center of their own village?
"I like to go in the morning best," he told her, "when some fishermen are just coming in with their night's catch. Some of the families have been bringing their boats in at the same spot for years, so that everyone takes it for granted that certain places belong to certain men. That's why no one really dares to interfere when Jesus sits and talks, because everyone knows that that spot belongs by right to Simon and Andrew."
"Why should they want to interfere?"
"The overseers think he keeps the men from starting their work, not the fishermen. They have been out all night, and their work is done. It's the men loading the trading boats who stop and listen when they should be working, and people like me with work waiting to be done at home." There was so much he could never find words to make her see. The lake, gray and still at sunrise, the hills beyond like huddled sheep, the first lines of camels and donkeys coming sleepily to the water's edge, the crowing of a cock somewhere in the town, and the first busy chirping of sparrows, and abruptly the swifts coming from nowhere, filling the air, darting over the water. And then suddenly the sun, leaping over the hills, warm and yellow, so that the mists melted and the lake shone blue and sparkling. The boats coming in, dragging the nets with their heavy burdens of fish, the smoke of little fires quickly lighted, and the fragrance of roasting fish. Worth getting up in the dark, even when his tired muscles pleaded for a little more rest. Worth the long walk to the city and the waiting. But how could he put it into words? And how could he tell of the people, the women who came down to help their men spread the wet nets on the shore, the almost naked men, their shoulders glistening, dragging the heavy baskets up from the boats, spreading the fish on flat stones to be salted and dried, the never-ending lines of men with sacks of grain and baskets of fruits and vegetables? "Jesus stands on the shore and talks to them all," he told Leah. "His friends to start with, and people like me. And then there are the beggars and cripples. Heaven knows where they sleep, but every morning they drag themselves down to the shore, partly to hear Jesus, and partly because Simon and Andrew and the women always give them some fish. Then there are curious people who come because they see a crowd. It drives the overseers crazy when their men stop to listen.
Sooner or later, they break in and drive the men away. Sometimes Jesus gets into one of Simon's boats and goes out from the shore a little. That way they can't order him away, but the crowds on the shore can still hear him.
"What did he say to them today?"
she would ask, and Daniel would do his best to remember. He would try to call back the lakeside and hear the lap of the water and the shouts of the workmen and even the breathing of the men and women packed close around him. He could hear their stillness and that deep, steady voice. Sometimes he could remember almost word for word because Jesus had left an unforgettable picture in his mind. He told us a story about a traveler who fell among thieves who beat him and left him half dead beside the road. And a priest and a Levite came by and saw him and passed by on the other side. But a cursed Samaritan stopped and bound up his wounds and took care of him. I wish the story had been about a Jew instead. If Jesus means that Jews and Samaritans should treat each other like neighbors, that is foolish. It could never happen. Often the words themselves eluded him, and only the memory of the voice struck troubled echoes deep within him. It was true, he did like best to go in the morning, not only because he loved the lake at dawn and the bustle of the work beginning and the walk back through the fields fresh washed from the night dew, but also because then, in the clear bright sunlight, nothing seemed impossible. He could truly believe that the kingdom of God was coming nearer, and he could almost hear the sound of trumpets in the distant hills. When he went to the city in the evening, everything seemed different, and he was not so sure. A sadness seemed to hang over the world. At night, people came flocking to the home of Simon the fisherman, where Jesus lived in a booth on the rooftop. There the workers would gather, weary from a day of hard labor at the forge or the wharves or the vineyards. They would crowd into the small room, spilling out and filling the narrow yard, sprawling on the trampled earth so close-packed that one could scarcely find a way between the bodies. It was at night that the hungry, who had not eaten all day, came to be fed, and the down and out and worthless. It was at night that they brought their kinfolk on litters. The air was thick with the day's heat and the stench of bodies and the smell of fever. The eyes of the ill and lame, which looked up with hope in the new morning, were glazed at night with a long day's suffering. Daniel was disgusted at the way that they jostled each other and tore at the food and snatched bread from the helpless, and at the way no one bothered when some poor creature, who could only crawl on hands and knees, was passed over or even trodden on. At night, Jesus too looked weary. His brilliant flashing eyes were dark with pity, yet he never turned away, never refused to speak to them. While he talked, they all forgot for a while. You could see their faces turned upward to the light that streamed from the open door, and you could see that his words touched their minds and hearts like some healing ointment, and that the scars on their spirits that came from being beaten and kicked and turned away all day long lost their smart and for a short time did not matter. Often a man's body was healed, and he leaped up full of new strength, and then a new hope coursed through them all. But as Daniel went home, with the black heat pressing him down, all the misery he had seen dragged at him, clinging like burrs to his spirit, and he did not hear any distant trumpets. On these nights, it was difficult to find anything to tell Leah. When he lay down and tried to sleep, the same question went on and on in his mind. When? How long must the world go on like this? There was one story he almost wished he had not told Leah, because she asked for it over and over again.
"Tell me about the little girl who was sick," she would beg.
Daniel would repeat the words that he had said so often that they were like a lesson memorized in school. Jesus went to her house and...
"No, begin at the beginning," she would demand like a child. "When you were waiting on the beach."
So he would begin, knowing that nothing but the whole story, just as he had told it so many times, would satisfy her. "We were waiting on the beach. Jesus had been across the lake to visit some of the villages, he and some of his followers, and they were coming back in a boat. People had been waiting for him since before dawn, and they were hungry and hot, but they were bound they wouldn't leave before they had seen him. Finally, someone saw the boat coming, and they all stood up and strained their eyes. And as it got nearer, they went wild. You'd have thought he was a prince, the way they screamed and cheered. It was all Simon and James could do to make room for him to step on shore.
I think Simon was trying to persuade him to get back into the boat again, the way he sometimes has to do, because for all they call him master and teacher, they lose their wits and have no regard for him at all. But just then there was a shout behind the crowd, and everyone turned around. Those in the back were pushing to make room for someone, and we saw a man trying to get through to Jesus. Joel whispered, "It's Jairus." And then people began to step on each other's toes to get out of the way. Some of them tried to hide behind the others for fear Jairus would recognize them. Jairus is one of the rulers of the synagogue. I think even Joel looked a little scared. Jesus' friends moved up close around him. No one was quite sure what was going to happen, but Jesus made a sign for them to stand aside, and he just stood quietly and waited. Jairus passed very close to me. His cloak was twisted sideways, and he was panting as though he had been running. No one need have bothered to hide, because he did not see anyone or anything except the one man he was looking for. What happened was the last thing we expected. Jairus went down in front of Jesus like a beggar and stretched out his hands, and his voice was so low and hoarse that only those who stood very near could understand what he said. But the word went through the crowd. His daughter was dying, the only child he had. Then Jesus said, "No, tell me first what Joel said." "Oh, Joel said, 'The only child he has, poor man, she is the apple of his eye.'"
"The apple of his eye," Leah would repeat softly, caressing the words.
Of course, I felt sorry for him, but I thought, too, what a chance it was for Jesus, an important man like this, a ruler. I thought if Jesus could bargain with him, but of course he would never think of that. He only reached out his hand and helped the man up and started straight for Jairus' house. The crowd let them through and then flocked after like a bunch of sheep and me along with them, because when a crowd like that starts to move, you don't stop to think. I was curious as anyone to see what would happen. But halfway to the synagogue, we saw a man hurrying along the street, and he met Jairus and Jesus and stopped them. I could not hear what he said, but I could see his face, and I knew that he had bad news. They told me afterwards he said the girl was dead, and not to bother the teacher any more. But before Jairus could speak, Jesus put his hand on the man's arm and said something quietly, and they went on again, and all of us after. Then we heard the women wailing and the flutes playing, and the women in the crowd began to howl too, out of sympathy, and Jesus turned around to us and said, "Do not weep. She is not dead, but sleeping." And none of us knew what to think. The women at the door of the house were weeping and jeering at him, both at the same time. Then Jesus told the crowd to stay back, and he gave a sign to Simon and John and James, the three who were always nearest to him, and he took them into the house with him. And in a moment all the mourners who had been wailing in the house came out. Some of them were angry, and some of them were frightened, but Jairus shut the door behind them.
"I wish you had gone inside," Leah would say now.
Well, I couldn't, and neither could any of the others, except those three.
We have only their word for what happened. They said the child lay on her bed, and they would have sworn, too, that she was dead. But Jesus did not hesitate at all. He just walked up to the bed and reached down and took her hand and spoke to her.
"Tell me," Leah would whisper, "tell me exactly what he said."
He said, "Little girl, get up," just as though she were asleep. And she woke up and got up and walked. And then Jesus said, "Give her something to eat," and he went away before her father and mother had a chance to say anything. When he came out to the street, no one dared to ask what had happened because there was something about his face. I can't describe it, but I have seen him look like that at other times, as though he had come to the very end of his strength. Simon and John understand when he looks like that, and they got him through the crowd and back to their house, and everyone knew better than to try to follow.
"The little girl, was she really well?"
"Yes, I have seen her walking with her father. You'd never guess she had been ill."
"Is she pretty?"
"Yes," Daniel would say, although he had not actually noticed, because it seemed to please Leah to have her pretty.
"Yes," Leah would sigh, "of course she must be pretty, and she must be very happy."
Daniel wished she would not keep asking for the story. It seemed wonderful to him at the time, but it had a puzzling aspect as well. It hadn't seemed to make any difference. Some of the followers thought that Jairus had offered to pay Jesus, and that Jesus had refused, and Daniel could not understand this when all those people were clamoring to be fed every night, and Jairus would never have missed the money. At any rate, the thing had been hushed up, by Jesus' own order, they said. Some of the disciples had grumbled about it, too. Simon, who had been in the house when it happened, would not talk about it at all. But Daniel noticed that Simon seldom went out in his boat now, and he stayed close to Jesus wherever he went. The fisherman watched his teacher more carefully than ever, protecting him from the carelessness of the crowd, and when Jesus spoke, Simon's eyes never left his face. One day, as Daniel finished the story, Leah sat silent for a long time. "Do you think Jesus will ever come to our village?" she asked finally. "He did once, and he may again."
"If he came here, would there be a great crowd of people?"
"There always is, wherever he goes."
"Like the people who watched the day we came here?"
"You think that was a crowd? That was only a handful. Where Jesus is, they come by the hundreds." He could see she had no way of imagining people by hundreds.
"Do women come?"
"Of course."
"Do the people crowd together and push each other?"
"It's all you can do to stay on your 2 feet sometimes." She was silent so long that he thought she had stopped thinking about it. Then she asked,
"Are there children, too?"
"Oh, yes. Usually some children."
"Do they hurt the children?"
"Of course they don't. What gave you such an idea?"
"Jesus wouldn't let them hurt the children, would he?"
"He won't even let them send the children away when they're a nuisance. He insists on talking to them and finding out their names and listening to their foolishness. It makes some of the men furious, as though he thought children were important." She sat silent for a long time, and this time Daniel asked, very carefully, "If he comes, will you go with me to see him?" Leah did not speak, only lowered her head and hid her face behind her veil. How changed she is, he thought, filled with hope as he looked at his sister. It must be Thaisha's visits, for Thaisha came often now, walking out from the city with Joel to stay with Leah while the boys met in the watchtower. Each time she brought some small gift, a lily bulb to plant in the garden, a tiny alabaster jar of perfume, a skein of scarlet thread. She had opened for Leah a whole new world. After Thaisha's last visit, he had come into the house and found Leah peering into the tiny hand mirror of polished bronze that had been Thaisha's latest gift, peering so earnestly that she had not even heard him come in. There had been something in her face, a searching and a wistfulness that still haunted him. Sometimes when he talked, she did not seem to hear him at all, but seemed to be listening intently for some expected sound. Often there was a dreaming look in her blue eyes. Twice, when the first patter of early rain had passed like footsteps along the street outside, she had flown to the garden door and flung it open and stood looking out into the dark, damp garden. Girls were strange creatures. Would Thaisha understand all this? Perhaps it was only his imagining, but it stirred in him an odd uneasiness that he could not put into words. There was another satisfaction in these days. As Daniel grew confident of the skill in his own hands, his work became a source of pleasure. It was satisfying to give a villager a pair of hinges for his house, and to know that they were not only strong and well-balanced, but exactly matched and pleasing to look at as well. He became aware that something more than usefulness could take shape under his hammer, and he began to experiment. One sultry afternoon, when the work was slack, he picked from the floor a bit of bronze which had dropped from a molten mass. Seeing its dull shine between his fingers, he had an idea. He heated it carefully, pulled it from the fire with the smallest tongs, and tapped it gently with Simon's finest hammer. After several tries, he achieved a stroke delicate enough so that it would not flatten the small lump, and presently he managed to beat out a fine wire. He heated it again and twisted it between his fingers, and watched it slowly take the shape of a tiny, slender bow, no longer than his little finger. For a moment he stared at it with pure pleasure. Then he had a further inspiration. He rolled out and sharpened a slender bronze pin, which could pass down like an arrow between the bow and the fine wire of its string, so that the bow became a brooch, such as he had seen the city folk wear to fasten their cloaks. Then he hid his experiment away, half ashamed of it and half proud. He would keep it to remind him of his purpose. "He trains my hands for war, so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze." He thought again of Jesus, and his hopes flared anew. Surely this man, like David of old, had the strength of God in him. If he willed, he could bend the bow of bronze. But was Jesus training his hands for war? Daniel was not sure. He must go back again that night to the garden in Bethsaida. For Daniel, the month of Ab was a time of waiting. It was only afterwards that he remembered these days as a time of quietness and hope.